Thank you all for coming to hear about locusts. My name is Justin Kiggins. I use he, him pronouns. But to start us off, actually, I would love it if we could go around really quick. We have a relatively, not a huge group here. I would love if we could go around, and if you don't mind, introducing yourself and telling everybody what your favorite animal is.
Animal or insect?
Yeah, let's start on the right and go across the room.
I'm Max. My favorite animal is a bear.
Ooh.
Probably a grizzly.
Nice.
Dan Wilson Fay, favorite animal, probably a Western tanager.
I'm Noah, my favorite animal is a monkey. Not a particular.
Awesome.
Jerry Fay, eagle.
Marvy Fay, cat.
Awesome.
Dog.
Frank, and my husband and I are the bunnies.
The bunnies?
The bunnies, yeah.
Awesome.
Kristen, I'm lots but deer, so I'm happy here.
Yes.
I'm Andrew, and I would say dogs also.
Awesome.
I'm Tiffany, and I just like baby animals of every iteration.
Kim, and I love like farm animals, goats, cattle, sheep.
Awesome.
I'm Sam, and probably turtle.
Oh, fantastic.
Kate and pig.
Catherine and dog.
I'm Debbie, I use she, they pronouns, and I love all whales.
Yes.
Okay. I'm Gail, and I love dogs.
Go ahead.
I'm Kathy, and the truth is dog, but somehow giant sloth comes to mind.
Good morning, I'm Tom, he, him, and today it would probably be a red panda.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Terry and bobcat.
I'm Linda and either a dolphin or an otter, because they always look like they're playing. And
yeah, yeah.
I'm Jillian and also dogs.
Awesome.
I'm Jamie and I'm majoring in animal science, so I have a lot of favorite animals, but I'd have to say a wolf.
Awesome.
I'm Trina, and I like otters and hummingbirds.
Oh, awesome. Mm-hmm. And if you don't mind introducing yourself and your favorite animal.
Annette. A pig.
Pig, awesome. And we've got a couple folks up in the peanut gallery.
I'm Emma Kate, and I was going to say red panda, but somebody already said that, so I think I'll amend and say a honey badger.
I'm Stacy, I use she, her pronouns, and I'm with the sea otter team.
Nice. Awesome. I'm only a little bit disappointed that nobody said locust. but that's okay.
Second favorite.
Awesome. So I think that, you know, one of my own, why I love giving this series of talks here at Holden I love the way that Holden embraces the beauty in the natural world, and I personally find a lot of beauty in the scientific world that's around us. And I was recently reading an article by a fantastic science writer, Ed Yong, diving into animal sensory worlds. And he has this quote that just really, I was reading this on the boat ride up the lake, and it just really clicked with me for a lot of the beauty that I find in talking about this kind of stuff in the Holden community. He says, "To perceive the world through other senses is to find splendor in familiarity and the sacred in the mundane." A lot of what we're going to be talking about is really just animals living their lives. Like, they're just living their lives just like you and I, but they have access to entire worlds that we don't have access to. And I'm really excited to be able to share that with a little bit of that with you today and through the series this week. A little bit about me. As I said, I use he/him pronouns. I live in Phoenix, Arizona. This is the homeland of the Acoma Odham, Tohono O'odham, and Hohokam people. I have a PhD in computational neurosciences from UC San Diego, where I studied auditory cognition and perception in European starlings. I'll be talking a little bit about them on Friday. The bulk of my research focus was on auditory perception and really focused on songbirds. But part of my motivation for that work and what that intersected with much more broadly is the kind of the sensory worlds of animals. Currently, in my current career, through working in academia and doing research, I found that I had a lot of skills and a lot of passion for building tools to help scientists. So in my current work, I work as a product manager at a nonprofit foundation in Silicon Valley. We're working with a global community to build an open source data analysis platform for microscopy and scientific imaging. Doing research and being in myself is not what I'm up to these days. But I'm really excited about this this type of work and super excited to share with you. But if you are curious about scientific philanthropy and data analysis and data science and open science and these things, feel free to bug me and chat. The series today, over this week, I'm going to be diving in to depth on four creatures. I'm going to talk a little bit about some adjacent creatures to these folks as well. So with today's, we'll start our conversation about locusts. So, especially in a religious community like Holden that comes from a Christian tradition, most people's familiarity with locusts might have started in biblical stories and in Exodus. Very early on in the Old Testament, we start hearing about locusts. Moses reached out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord directed an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. The locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled in all the territory of Egypt. They were very numerous. There had never been so many locusts, nor would there ever be so many again. For they covered the surface of the whole land so that the land was darkened, and they ate every plant of the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Therefore, nothing green was left on tree or plant of the field throughout the land of Egypt. The level of destruction that this brings is terrifying, right? It's just absolutely terrifying that over 2 days you could have a wind come about, and then all of a sudden, swarms and swarms of locusts just descending on your crops. I don't know. Personally, whether I can vouch for whether there had never been so many locusts, nor would there ever be so many again. But locusts are a modern problem as well. So from 2019 to 2021, there's a massive locust infestation in Eastern Africa. So, as the pandemic settled in, the Eastern Horn of Africa was in the middle of a huge swarm of locusts that they were dealing with already. This infestation caused massive challenges in food security, and modern techniques and modern analyses let researchers and folks literally follow these swarms and track these swarms as they spread throughout Ethiopia and Somalia. Locusts are not simply a biblical, a biblical creature. They are a modern challenge that we have to deal with as well. The locust species of locust that currently spreads through Eastern Africa and Saharan Africa in the Middle East. And the one that was most likely described in Exodus is the desert locust. Does anybody know what is a locust?
A grasshopper.
A locust is a grasshopper. And you can look at it, right, and it looks very similar to a grasshopper, right? Like it's got the head, it's kind of got the long wings, it's got those legs that stick up. And what's interesting about locusts is that they toggle through two key phases. In their solitary phase, they're just a grasshopper. They're just a grasshopper like any other grasshopper. They do grasshopper things. They're largely solitary. You know, they kind of hang out on their own. You know, it's not very often that we see like groups of grasshoppers congregating. They're pretty solitary creatures. They avoid plants with toxic compounds, as one does. And they're not, actually that's wrong. I ignore that third bullet point. In their gregarious phase though, which is the phase that scientists refer to locusts when they're like being locusts as we think about them. This is what their phase when they start swarming with other locusts. They also go through an interesting change that they start to consume more plants with toxic compounds. We can talk about why that might be. And they go through and they do this migration as a massive group of locusts. One of the big questions, you know, in Exodus we hear that like the locusts came after a bunch of wind, right? There's like these winds that brought the locusts. One of the interesting things is that, you know, we've I think known for a very long time that locust swarms emerge following periods of rain after drought. So when you have a long drought and then a large period of rain, this tends to trigger locust swarms. But we could get a little bit more detailed than that. Like what is it about all the rains that triggers this type of swarming gregarious behavior? That wasn't supposed to show up yet. Okay. The answer is actually crowding. So simply crowding together locusts in their kind of grasshopper solitary form for 4 hours can trigger their transition into this gregarious phase. So you take a bunch of these grasshopper locusts, you stick them in a box. You know, you put it on the shelf, you come back 4 hours later, and you'll have locusts coming out of the box. So one of the things that scientists then ask is, okay, so I can stick all these locusts around, what is it about being close to one another that causes this type of crowding behavior? We're now 2 years of social distancing of like varying levels. And I certainly remember, particularly like as the pandemic like started easing up and things started that like, oh, like I can like smell people's like body odor or perfume again, or like, you know, like people are standing too close to me in line at the store, right? And so there's a lot of different sensory sensations that we have when we're in close quarters with other folks. One of the interesting things is that, you know, researchers basically drilled in fairly early and said, okay, well, what is it that's actually triggering this, what is it about crowding that's causing the locusts to transition into this gregarious phase? Is it that they see other locusts? Is it the visual cues of other locusts? Is it because they can smell other locusts? Or is it actually tactile? Is it actually like the physical presence of the other locusts? And what this plot is showing on the right is a study where bars that are high up on, so these bars where we have very high values, is the likelihood that the locusts remain in their solitary phase after 4 hours or something of of proximity. And what they're looking at is on the far left, with no visual, olfactory, or tactile cues, so like truly, you know, remaining solitary. On the far right is with all three cues available, and then a whole variety of combinations in between. And the key kind of takeaway here is that if they have visual cues or olfactory cues alone, they remain solitary. If they have tactile cues at all, then they'll transition into this gregarious behavior. And weirdly, if they have visual and olfactory cues, but not the tactile cues, that can also trip the transition as well. So some kind of combination. But by and large, like the tactile cues are the overwhelming, that's the overwhelming cue that triggers locus into their gregarious phase. So, what is it, where are they, how are they, what do we mean when we say tactile cues?
Bumping into each other.
Yeah, like bumping into each other, right? So, scientists, all right, let's take it one step further. Is it their headbutting? Is it their antennae bumping into each other? Is it the thorax bumping into each other? Is it their front legs? Is it their hind legs? What is it that's triggering this this behavior, this transition? Well, it turns out that you can actually transition them into the gregarious behavior just by poking their leg. So on the top here, we have kind of this side view. Locusts have brains, and they have insects, unlike us, have these like kind of bundles of not quite brains, but they're sort of like mini processing centers through their body that are called ganglia. And so you can kind of think of this similar to our spinal cord. And then they've got, you know, various nerves that go out that can sense different things. And by poking different parts of the locust, what research has identified is that the hind leg is actually the primary area that triggers the transition into the gregarious behavior. So it's very specifically kind of sensory stimulation through this hind leg that can then trigger processing in these ganglia that actually starts to trigger the gregarious behavior. So it's literally their legs bumping into each other is what ends up going through and triggering this. We can see this in more detail, and you know, kind of to give some sense of how scientists and how researchers actually like ask these types of questions, this kind of outlines what one of these studies might look like. So this is a what they do is that this is a box that they can place the locust in, in its grasshopper form. They put it right in the middle of the box. And then they watch it and they see where it goes. And what they'd have is on the left-hand side of the box, kind of off view over here, are a bunch of other locusts. And off on the right-hand side of the box are no locusts. And they can smell them and they can hear them and, you know, and see them and all these kinds of things. And so, what the researchers are asking when we say, you know, what this percent is, of like this percent transition to the gregarious, part of what they're looking at is this animal trying to go hang out with other locusts, or is it trying to go and be by itself? And that's the main like measure that they're looking at. And so what they can see is that and what this is plotting is actually four different ways of triggering that sensory stimulus. And so they can do this by, so one of this, one of the, sorry. So if we look back here, so we know that stimulating this this leg is, you know, causing this behavioral change. But to get that behavioral change, something needs to be changing in their brain. Their brain's controlling their behavior. You know, their brain, they're making decisions about whether they go closer to the other locus or not. Something's changing in their brain in order to make this happen. So what's changing? And what's mediating those changes? And what researchers identified is that it's actually serotonin. So serotonin, common neurotransmitter throughout the animal kingdom, in humans and in mammals, serotonin is it's strongly associated with depression. Lack of serotonin is associated with depression. But serotonin neurotransmitters, they're used by the body in all kinds of different ways. And the ways that neurotransmitters are used in humans are not necessarily the way that the same chemicals might be used in other animals, particularly when we start talking about like the insect world. And so what researchers identified is that that whether they are going through and crowding, actually physically crowding locus, or through mechanosensory stimulation of the hind leg, poking the hind leg with a stick, or electrically stimulating, causing little shocks on that hind leg that would trigger then the nerve to be able to respond, or through that combination of sight and smell but no actual like physical stimulation with other locus, that in those instances where the locusts were more likely to transition into the gregarious phase and spent more time on the left side of the box, they also have higher levels of serotonin in their nervous system. Yeah?
Are you saying that the higher level of serotonin triggers the transition to the gregarious?
That's what it seems to be, yeah. That's what it seems to be, is that the and I don't know, there's probably like clever ways to try to break that down to get the cause and effect, and so I don't know if the full, I'm not familiar with the studies that have tried to, if they've tried to break that down super carefully, but yes, I think in all likelihood, it seems likely that serotonin is being triggered and is being increased, and that this is causing lots of behavioral changes throughout the brain. Yeah.
So, I mean, out of nature, there's not going to be electrical stimulation.
No.
So that would be irrelevant to
exactly
locusts in the wild.
Yeah, no, and there's a couple of reasons that this ends up being relevant. Basically, as we go through like crowding to mechanosensory to electrical stimulation, what we're doing is we're getting rid of confounding factors, and by demonstrating that only electrical stimulation will trigger both the gregarious behavior, well, both the serotonin increase as well as the gregarious behavior, that gives us more confidence that it's actually this particular nerve and signals from this particular nerve going up through the thoracic ganglia that's triggering this, as opposed to something weird like I'm poking the that by poking the leg, the locust is hearing that, and that's actually what is triggering this, but we didn't capture that effectively. So by zeroing in on and demonstrating that electrical stimulation of the nerve itself causes this, that lets us zero in on like exactly what the mechanism is for this.
One question is that all regardless of the age of the locust, or is there a maturity factor?
No, that's a good question. There is a maturity factor. I don't remember the details of this on how maturity intersects with these tendencies. Like, I don't remember if locusts can transition into the gregarious phase while they're still juveniles, or if that only happens in adulthood. I don't remember the details on that. I'm sorry.
Justin, I have a question.
Yeah. Yeah.
The word gregarious makes it sound like they're getting friendlier. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a positive thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, humans who are crowded in together get grumpier generally.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure they, I don't know anything about locust emotions, but I mean,
yeah.
Is there anything, I don't know.
Yeah, no, they, so they, in their gregarious phase, part of the, you know, it's meant as a contrast to solitary,
okay.
Right? So that they are drawn toward others. This actually kind of, so if you remember, I mentioned that they prefer toxic compounds
yeah.
in the gregarious phase. Part of the reason that they start to prefer toxic compounds is that that's one of the reasons that their color changes, is because they're starting to eat more toxic plants. As we, you know, with many animals, bright colors is like, stay away from me, I'm toxic. And so, and I, if I recall, they do get a little bit more aggressive with one another when they're in that gregarious phase.
So it's
as well.
Not like, and again, I might be anthropomorphizing, but, you know, bees get angry. You know,
yeah, yeah.
It's
no, it's not really that. They just
yeah.
they get into this like swarm behavior. They get obsessed with eating food. They get very competitive over their space.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then so yeah. So in addition to being able to, oh yeah, this goes back to your question. So then in addition to being, I totally forgot that I had this slide in here. So with the serotonin, in addition to seeing the serotonin increase. If you provide serotonin receptor agonists, basically pharmaceutical drugs that that can block serotonin uptake and block the effects of serotonin, that if you add particular or sorry, that's an antagonist. If you can add agonists, so things that that increase the uptake of serotonin. Things like Prozac and like pharmaceuticals that we often treat for depression that can increase serotonin. As you add those serotonin receptor agonists, you're more likely to see these transitions into the gregarious phase as well. So overall, it seems to be that electrical signals being conducted through that hind leg nerve. In the wild, this would be due to locusts bumping into each other. This can trigger increases in serotonin in the locust brain, which then has all these changes in their brain.
One more question.
Yeah.
Why isn't this triggered when they bump into a twig with their hind leg?
It probably is.
Oh, okay.
But I think the key thing to... it probably is, but the key thing to remember is that what we're talking about is like 4 hours of crowding.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a cumulative effect, right? So a couple of bumps here and there aren't going to trigger it. You know, but once you keep having that, you keep having that stimulation over a long time, and this like, you know, stronger and stronger increase of serotonin in the system is what's going to then eventually trip that wire. So their behavior is changing. We know that the serotonin levels are increasing. We can kind of guess that you know, well, there's something changing in their brain, and we can actually see those effects. So some of the, you know, through the serotonin increase, and again, you know, the way that particular neurotransmitters work in other animals isn't the same way that it works in us. There's literally neurotransmitters that will do opposite things in insects versus humans. Because neurotransmitters are basically like basic chemical building blocks that evolutionary pressures have recruited different animals to use in different ways. But one of the things that we see is that as they transition into the gregarious phase, we see, sorry, I got distracted by the birds. that we see increases in the size of their brains. So their brains naturally are very small, but you know, very diligent graduate students can sit there with a scalpel under a microscope and very carefully dissect out a locust brain and stick it under a microscope. And that's what we are seeing off to the right here. So these big areas are basically right at their is their where the eyes are coming in, the optical lobes. So their eyes would be basically right on the outsides of these. And so what we have is on the right hand side are is a brain in the from a locust in the gregarious phase, and then on the left-hand side is the brain from the solitary phase. So it's like half of each brain. And so you can see how things are bigger on the right. And so by zeroing in on particular areas of the brain, part of what they identify is that that this is that, you know, some of these areas in the midbrain, which are associated with more complex processing, kind of higher order areas, are some of the ones that increase in size the most. What we mean by higher order areas, like an area that just you know, that is just purely bringing in sensory information would be considered very low level. Something that's helping to mediate decision making, something that's helping to mediate making decisions about the environment around us, that's what we refer to as kind of higher order areas. Yeah.
So what leads to these swarms of locusts or the grasshoppers becoming locusts? Are they doing more breathing, or are they, is it, I mean, how?
Yeah.
Because they have to congregate to do these swarms of locusts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are they there anyway? It's just when they become gregarious that they congregate and swarm like that.
Yeah. 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 That's a really good question, and that's exactly what it is. So I've got a few slides here that I'll talk about kind of their overall migration patterns and stuff.
Thank you.
But yeah, the short version of it is that. That they have kind of standard migration patterns that they engage in as grasshoppers, but then they lay eggs. They go through a reproductive cycle, but they do this when they're in the swarming behavior as well, and so then they just have more and more of them. So let's chat a little bit about how locusts migrate. I think this will get into a little bit more depth on those cycles. So, if you recall, Exodus, when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. In the gregarious phase, when they're doing this swarming behavior, they're mostly carried by the wind. So the biblical account is actually super consistent with swarming locusts. They're in this gregarious phase. They're just eating tons of stuff. They're, you know, trying to stay with other locusts. They definitely have a mob mentality behavior. They basically just go with the wind, and they largely follow the winds. However, there are also seasonal migration patterns that they engage in through North Africa and the Middle East and Sub-Saharan Africa. And these seasonal migration patterns are so that they can lay eggs and reproduce in particular breeding grounds. They have particular breeding areas in the spring through North Africa, through the Levant, the Arab Peninsula, and into Asia. As they transition into the Horn of Africa, as they transition into the spring, kind of in this sub-Saharan Africa region becomes one of their main breeding areas. As they move into the winter, they spend more time in the Horn of Africa, and then they kind of transition through. And so they follow these seasonal migration patterns to be able to, follow food, follow crops, based on major
Why are they an issue in Africa? It looks like maybe into India, mm-hmm. when we don't have that problem here.
Ooh, that's a really good question. Has anybody read Little House on the Prairie?
Yes, they did. Yeah. My parents, her dad, they lost everything.
They lost everything to
And to they had this. Many, many years of it, and then it wasn't a problem anymore.
And it wasn't a problem anymore, yeah. Yeah, so there were... the Rocky Mountain locust was super devastating in North America. We have records of it, at least going back to like 1700s and such in Maine. There's the account in Little House on the Prairie. According to Wikipedia, the largest, there was one swarm in the late 1800s that basically was the size of California through the plains region. The Rocky Mountain locusts basically migrated back and were largely in the Rocky Mountains and would migrate down into the plains. They would toggle into gregarious phases, wipe out crops. They disappeared. It's completely extinct. So as of the early 1900s, went totally extinct. Nobody really knows why. We have very few, there's like, despite it being absolutely massive and such a huge issue, we kind of didn't notice when they disappeared, sort of like, and we have very few, it's not like they're in museums and such. I think a couple of them, like the best DNA evidence we have from them was from some glacier in Montana or something like this that they were found in. But the best, they went extinct our best guess for why they went extinct seems largely due to farming and cattle grazing in the western states. That basically, as you started farming and cow grazing in riparian areas.
So the ones that have disappeared here, mm-hmm. are they different than the ones in Africa?
Yeah, totally different species.
So if the ones from Africa got brought here, it would not impact our...
Probably not, yeah. Yeah, I don't know the details on that. I think that I should look into... Because I believe that some of the, like, the desert locusts have made their way to, like, the Caribbean and South America in the past, I think, through, like, their migration and trade winds and stuff. But yeah, I don't know the ecology well enough to know whether they would be viable in North America. So, yeah. Yeah. Cool. So yeah, so and that was the so it seems that that basically we knocked out their our best guess is that we knocked out the Rocky Mountain locust breeding grounds through cattle tramping through riparian areas where they laid their eggs, and farmers in the prairies plowing fields and obliterating their reproductive zones. Yeah.
I was just thinking about that too. I think it was in Timothy Egan's book, The Worst Hard Times, where he has some very vivid descriptions of the swarms of locust during the Dust Bowl.
Okay.
And you know so much of the vegetation had been destroyed that there were tremendous winds. So when
yeah.
you talk about the wind being a huge factor, it seems like that might have played a big role. And then as there was replanting, there was less wind, less of what happened in the Dust Bowl.
Yeah,
Does
yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it could be. I'm trying to remember the timing of when these guys went extinct. And I think it was early 1900s. Like, I want to say like that by like 1910, like they seem to have been totally gone. So I don't know whether the timing times out with the Dust Bowl. But it wasn't actually until 2014 that the species was officially considered to be extinct. It was one of these things that we... There was a lot of speculation for a while that they had just gone into like permanent grasshopper phase, and just that like conditions weren't triggering them into a locust phase. But some DNA evidence and stuff shows that they were indeed a distinct species. So, Let's see. Okay, so one of the interesting things with these migration patterns is that these migratory movements can and are often against the winds. So we can, you know, there are trade winds through through Africa that and as these as the locusts in their solitary phase are migrating to different breeding grounds, they will fly against the wind. So they have some awareness of where they're trying to go. I'm going to be talking in more depth about this type of migration tomorrow, because locusts and monarchs are actually very similar in how they migrate. But basically, locusts have a specialized portion of the eye that can pick up polarized light, and this can help them to identify which way north is, and assist in their migration patterns. So they have some very specialized structures to be able to figure out which way they need to go. So what then has changed since the pharaonic times? You know, in the Moses or the writer of Exodus described that as the greatest locust swarm that had ever come or ever would come. What has changed since then? Can somebody share with everybody what the difference is between the kind of tan areas and the green areas?
Deserts or tan?
Yeah, deserts and vegetation. And so, you know, as we look at northern Africa, we can see the massive Saharan desert. We can see visually the Nile Delta, right? Like, and you can see the green of the Nile Delta that was just even to this day, produces tons of crops. And then we can see, sub-Saharan Africa, the rainforests through the area. And when we think about what these areas look like, the Saharan Desert is kind of pure desert. Sub-Saharan Africa, which is kind of the primary breeding areas of the desert locust, is much more lush. It's much more green. And one of the reasons that we see this this stark line between the Sahara and the rest of Africa is due to something called the intertropical convergence zone. And so what we have with the ITCZ is that basically, we have trade winds. We have kind of these massive, these major winds that bring in, this is what brings in hurricanes to the southern U.S. This is all based on the rotation, kind of the combination of the rotation of the Earth and the magnetic poles set up these major wind currents. And near the equator, we have the intertropical convergence zone, which is effectively where these rotational cells that kind of go in this direction in the northern hemisphere and go in the opposite direction in the southern hemisphere bring a ton of moisture into near the equator. And seasonally, this changes. From July to January, we see a shift in where this convergence zone is. It isn't perfectly centered on the equator. This shift is a big aspect of what causes like your monsoon seasons in Southeast Asia, for example. So it's the shift of the intertropical convergence zone that causes these changes in Southeast Asia. As we look to 10,000 years ago, was a period of time that they call the African Humid Period. That the ITCZ was actually more north than it is today, and was much farther north into Africa. So this kind of band that we can see, that you saw, that we see today, in that separates, the ITCEZ effectively separates sub-Saharan, the Sahara from sub-Saharan Africa, that band was much farther north. And so throughout what is the modern Sahara was largely grassland back then. By, you know, careful documentation, you know, we see slabs and scrolls throughout the pharaonic period of various animals that are now in sub-Saharan Africa that were recorded to be to live in North Africa. And what we can see is that over a period of thousands of years, that we had many of these animals that went extinct in Northern Africa and only exist in Southern Africa overall. And so it seems very likely that also kind of thinking back to Exodus and to this time, that Egypt itself, which still, you know, gets locust swarms and such today, but was likely in a very different setting and likely had many more locusts and locusts that were much more proximal than they are today as well. So it seems not unlikely that the that folks of biblical times were dealing with locusts much more than they do today. So as a summary, our, you know, if you remember anything, locusts switch from this solitary to gregarious phases, fundamentally based on population density. And this appears to be triggered primarily through mechanical receptors on their legs that will trigger this transition between the phases mediated by serotonin increases. This transition is also accompanied by a loss of aversion to toxic compounds in certain plants. They have this these specialized brain regions to be able to sense polarized light. And aridification of Northern Africa over the past 10,000 years has likely moved their breeding grounds around from what folks experienced in biblical times. So with that, thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Take any more questions.